This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show!
In my hands, I hold the ashes. In my veins, black petroleum. In my chest, fire catches. In my way, setting sun. Dark clouds gather round me. To the west, my soul's bound, but I will go.
Welcome to the 11th episode of Comics in Black and White. This week I have Jay with me again, and we are here to talk about Jeff Lemire and his book Essex County. This was one of the first few things I read with Jeff Lemire. I checked out Jeff Lemire myself because he was starting to write for Valiant, and I was aware of him, but I hadn't read anything yet. So I read Trillium, I started reading Sweet Tooth, and I got Essex County on a sale on Comixology for, I don't remember how much, but it had to have been cheap, probably like $5 or something like that. And it's one of those books, I know that we've talked about this with other books, where I took forever to start reading it because I would, you know, open it up on the app and I'd look at the art. There's no color and the art's a little more simplistic. And it's sometimes it's hard to get over that stuff. And I think this was the first book where I really finally dove into it. And as soon as I really got rolling on it, flew through it so quick. And this was the book that kind of taught me to look past the art. And when you do that, you're going to end up really absorbing the art and appreciating it for what it is. What made you read Essex County, Jay?
I've also become, and not more recently than you, really enamored with Lemire's work. Of course, I was introduced to him through his work at Valiant, specifically Bloodshot Reborn. And he also co-wrote, I think, The Valiant with Matt Kent. Mm-hmm. And I've just been hearing, you know, more and more good things about him, and I know he did like a collaboration with Scott Snyder here recently. And everything
was that After Death.
Yeah, After Death. I think they just put out the last of that. But so it's as you start paying attention to comics, especially comics news, which I try to keep up with. That name, his name, just keeps coming up over and over. He's like one of the more prolific creators in the industry right now. It seems like,
yeah,
you know, doing everything. He's like, he's doing Bloodshot Reborn and Descender, and he did that After Death, and I don't know what all he's doing currently. So it's like you can't.
Yeah, it kind of seems like he did some of the creator-owned stuff that pretty much made his name. Like Essex County, Sweet Tooth. I think Sweet Tooth was really the big point where that was for Vertigo, but it was all him. I mean, he did the art, he did the writing. Matt Kent actually guested on the art on a few issues of that. But it seems like it was when he started writing for Valiant was around the time. I mean, he was writing for DC already doing some stuff. And when he started writing for Valiant, that was around the time that he ended up with Marvel doing a bunch of stuff for them. And if I am correct, I believe he just left Marvel or is like right at the end of his tenure at Marvel. But yeah, this was kind of the time when he started writing with Valiant that it just seems like he went from that, you know, indie guy, you know, scratching to get work to just the world's his oyster. And he's kind of doing all sorts of stuff. He was doing some, you know, fairly big stuff with Marvel. He was writing Old Man Logan. He wrote All New Hawkeye, yeah, a bunch of other stuff. I mean, he wrote quite a few different titles while he was at Marvel. Yeah. And this book's kind of the root of it. This is the one with all the things he's done I've seen resonate with the most people.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things is you start reading about him, you start coming across all the references to it. And, you know, this thing won a lot of awards. You know, the American Library Association Award. It's been referenced in, you know, it was USA Today wrote about it, Booklist magazine. And these are magazines that aren't specifically covering, you know, comic and sequential art. They cover all of literature. And so when you can start, when you have a work that starts becoming that widely recognized, it's especially anything that's of a sequential art comic book nature, that's quite a statement to its impact of how it's being received.
Yeah, it's pretty huge. The first thing that got me into comic books was actually because Time Magazine had a list of the 100 greatest novels of the 20th century, and Watchmen was on there.
Right.
And Watchmen, obviously, is a comic book. So I finally, after just, no, I don't want to. I don't want to read comics. My wife actually was the one who got me to, hey, let's give this a shot. So I read it, and that was really what broke me into comics. I had read a little bit before that, but that was the point where I kind of saw that there was a lot more potentially there to comics than just the, you know, DC and Marvel superhero stuff that is made, you know, the most consumable for you know, comic book fans.
Right.
And this is a great example. Whenever something causes this kind of waves in, you know, outside of the comic community, like you just said, there's something to it. And I think that this is just a great example of what is the best that Jeff Lemire does. And it's something that I've never been a real big fan of his stuff for the big two. And I think it's because he's having to tell a story that they want told to an extent. You know, even if he has creative freedom in it, he's more bound by what he can do. And the heart that he puts in something like Essex County, I don't think it's the same in those other, you know, works that he does. But if you look at Essex County, if you look at Trillium, if you look at Sweet Tooth, if you look at Descender, I haven't read much of his newer stuff. I've read a little bit of Black Hammer. You just sent me an issue of, what did you send me?
Royal City. That's his newest.
Royal City, yeah. So I haven't read that yet. I know he has a few other things. One thing I decided for myself with Jeff Lemire is that I was better off getting stuff as it came out in trade rather than reading individual issues.
Right.
So that way I could just dive into the story and kind of stay in it throughout the story being told instead of having those little snippets where it's easy to kind of lose the thread.
Right.
But yeah, Essex County to me is just, I mean, it's just dripping with emotion. Some of the time that I was reading through this, I was actually feeling a little bit down myself, and man, some of this was kind of hard to read feeling that way going into it. But it's just, it's a beautiful story that, well, multiple stories that just, I mean, it's just so chock full of emotion.
Todd, did you say that? Cause I was kind of the same way. I was kind of second reread the other night, and I was, you know, kind of feeling, I don't know if I was just tired or out of it. And yeah, some of that part of it is just hard to get through. I mean, it's just like, I don't want to read this. This is not at all uplifting or seemingly uplifting because it's very honest and raw emotions and the experiences of all these people. It's just, you know, I'm talking about creator-owned work and independent work. There's as much emotion and just raw energy in this than any novel that I can think of having ever read. It has just as much impact as anything else I've ever encountered.
Yeah, and one of the things that's amazing about this with that is that the art is, I mean, the art's a lot simpler than a lot of the art we see. It's, you know, very much Jeff Lemire's style, but it also doesn't have the polish that some of his stuff going forward has because of the, you know, I'm assuming that some of the factors are the money behind producing it the way it was produced. Like, I don't know the whole story about how this was produced, but I would imagine that this is really him doing it on his own and then getting it published. Whereas, you know, when he goes on and does like Sweet Tooth, he's doing all the art and stuff, but he has Vertigo money behind it. He's not doing it and then hoping it gets out there. He's, you know, getting paid to do it. I'm flipping through it a little bit, and there's so many parts where there's no words, or very little words going on, but you look through and even with his art style, there's just so much expression in all of it that you don't need words to really portray the emotion. And he uses a lot of subtlety to get stuff across with his art.
Right.
You know, so this is the overall Essex County is basically three trades put together. There's Tales from the Farm, Ghost Stories, and The Country Nurse.
Right.
And as we go through these three stories, they're focusing on individuals, but then there's relations between all three of the stories. So the first story, Tales from the Farm, is about a boy named Lester who lives with his uncle. His mom passed away from cancer. He's never known his dad. But as you go through it, you find out who his dad is. The second story, Ghost Stories, is about two brothers. One goes to the big city to play hockey, and his brother, who is a much more talented hockey player than he is, gets brought up as soon as he turns 18 to play hockey with this minor league team. And it just kind of changes their life. But his brother wants to be back at the farm in Essex County, whereas the older brother that came up first, he wants to be in the city. And there's stuff that goes on there. And then that gets related back to the first story with who we find out Lester's dad stems from all this. And the third story is The Country Nurse. And it's a little less direct. The character the main character in The Country Nurse is a nurse, and she's not related to any of the characters from the other stories, but you see how their lives are all interwoven. It's just this big tapestry. And when you get to that third volume too, it has the lineage of these two different families. And The Country Nurse, her grandma in it is the oldest living person in Essex County or something like that. But
current living woman, yeah.
Yeah, so let's dive into Tales from the Farm a little bit. So this is about Lester. He dresses as a superhero. Definitely needs some escapism. Doesn't have a good relationship with his uncle, who took up taking care of him because there was nobody else to, and his mom died of cancer. One of the scenes that really sets the tone for how heartbreaking this book is his uncle is watching hockey and asks Lester to watch with him. And he says no thanks and goes upstairs and turns the game right on.
Right.
So that just really sets the divide up between them, where Lester wants to watch the hockey game, but he'd rather go watch it by himself than watch it with his uncle. We don't know any of the other stuff I said yet. We don't know that this is his uncle and not his dad. Actually,
he hasn't mentioned him as his uncle, but you don't know anything else. I mean, it's just this, you know, here he is, this distant relative, and or not distant, but, you know, not his immediate family. So, yeah, that's a very interesting thing. And one of the things I had to try to put aside, because Jeff Lemire grew up in Essex County, Ontario. So this, you know, this book is thinly veiled portrayal of the place he grew up. And so there's a danger of wanting to say, well, I wonder how much of this is autobiographical. And I had to put that out of my mind, because I was thinking probably none of it. I mean, yes, we all draw, any writer will draw some references from his own life and characters, but yeah, I don't think the story is autobiographical in any way. You know, that was one of the things, challenges I had early on with it, is trying to make, okay, relate this to how it might be the story of Lemire's own life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just flipped through it, and this point early on where they're both watching the hockey game, you don't know it's his uncle yet. Okay. That hasn't been said yet. The uncle refers to him as Lester, but Lester never refers to him as specifically anything back. But so that sets the tone right there for the divide between them. You know, Lester's asking him for money for a comic when they go into town. You know, like, there's a clear, the uncle doesn't understand the kid. The kid, you know, there's just a big divide between them. And then you see the kid started to connect with this guy who's working at the gas station where he's buying the comic at while his uncle's fueling up. The guy's nice to him, and then you go back to him and the uncle, and there's the divide. And then you see Lester start to become friends with this other guy, Jimmy. One of the things I love, too, about Jeff Lemire's stuff is when he portrays hockey in it at all, because he obviously is a real hockey fan, and, like, he portrays hockey well and accurately. I randomly, I don't remember when or why, it was probably we put something on TV with when my son was up or something, but I watched The Mighty Ducks, the movie.
Right.
And,
God, it's been years.
It made me, yeah. God, it was an awful movie. It made me really irritated in it when they're showing this, you know, it's just like kids or whatever, but they're in the playoffs, and it's, if you make the goal, you win, and if you don't, you lose. That's not how hockey works. There is never a point in hockey where you score and you win, but if you don't score, you would lose. If you don't score, you would just be tied at that point. So that always drove me nuts, that they put all this burden on this kid in the movie that, you know, that grows up to be the coach because he didn't make the game-winning shot, so they lost. That's not how that works. Lies. All lies. So I appreciate Jeff Lemire's, like, actual portrayal of hockey.
Right.
Yeah, so we go through. I mean, basically the story of this is he gets buddy-buddy with Jimmy. He has this kind of divide between his uncle. You start to see the story of his mom dying. The uncle not feeling comfortable taking him in, but he takes him in because his dying sister asked him to. And you start to realize as you go on that Jimmy is Lester's dad. But the uncle doesn't want him around.
Right.
So, and you know, all throughout this, we know that something happened in the past, but we don't exactly know what. I mean, they tell us that Jimmy wasn't there when the mom died.
Right.
So I'm assuming that is pretty much what caused the big divide, where the Uncle Ken doesn't want him in Lester's life.
Yeah, I got that impression too. That there was, unless there was something that happened, you know, somehow that Jimmy and I think Claire was a woman who's Lester's mother. They had some sort of separation, or he wasn't there when she was, you know, battling the cancer. So whatever that is, it's never really revealed, but because of it, you know, her brother Kenny, who's taking care of Lester now, yeah, he doesn't want anything. He doesn't want Lester knowing anything about it, but that keeps coming up. You know, the nurse actually, later on, will go up to him and tell him, you know, you need to think about telling Lester the truth. He needs to know the truth about his family at some point. And of course, he hesitates, and he knows he should do it, but he just struggles with actually sitting down and talking with Lester.
Yeah, he makes the comment. This is later on in the, I think it's in the second volume. This the whole story is definitely very interwoven. She tells him that, and he says that they're just starting to get along, because as we get towards the end of this first volume, stuff starts to happen, and Lester doesn't need the escapism as much, and he starts to break down the wall between him and his uncle. So Uncle Ken says he doesn't want to rock the boat, and the nurse, whose name I don't remember offhand, but we'll get to it, you know, basically tells him to stop being a chicken shit about it and do it. So yeah, you see a lot of change. You see how the things are connected, and that happens in the second story we get to at the end of the first story. So Lester has been getting more and more buddy buddy with Jimmy, but then Jimmy and Uncle Ken talk at some point, and Jimmy realizes that he kind of needs to, you know, make the split with Lester, because it's not the right thing to just make this a game that he's playing. And, you know, he needs to respect the uncle's wishes, but he does it in a way that doesn't make Lester feel abandoned. It really gives him the strength to move on, you know, the strength to let go of the being a superhero and, you know, go connect with his uncle. And it ends with, you don't see him getting along better with his uncle necessarily. You just see him take the mask and cape off, and that's the end of the first volume.
Right. And it was a very kind of an odd end to that, because it ended with this part that's obviously purely fantasy on Lester's part, you know, where because one of the things that they have been talking about, he and Jimmy were building a fort to get ready for this alien invasion. And, you know, so the way we see Lester and Jimmy separate at the end of that volume is tied in with that, you know, sort of fantasy that they've been sharing together, which is I thought was a brilliant way of ending it, but it was definitely something that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and thinking of reading this in its own volume without anything else being released yet, when it was first released, it leaves the end of the story without any sense of knowing what happens afterwards, but still a kind of a sense of completion. Like, he goes through the fantasy with Jimmy of the alien attack. And that's when Jimmy goes sailing down the river on his raft because he's been shot by the aliens and he's dying, you know.
Right.
And then Lester has the flashback to when his uncle first took him away from his home. So when Lester's mom died, he's about the same age he is here. I mean, he's not anything drastically different in age. So we know that Jimmy hasn't been in his life this whole time because he doesn't know that Jimmy's his dad.
Right.
So it's been a long time. And so then, you know, his mom dies, his uncle takes him, and his uncle's trying to connect with him, and he says that he has tickets to the hockey game that night. And so he's going to take Lester to that. And so they go off in a truck. And so Lester's just putting all these things together, like through this friendship he made with Jimmy, and Jimmy kind of segueing out of it in a good way. And he's thinking back to what his uncle did, and like you see Lester kind of grow and, you know, realize that his uncle doesn't know how to connect with him, but his uncle's been trying, and he sees it now after this. So he hangs the cape and the mask up on the tree and goes walking back to the farm.
I think that's what's part of the brilliance of this, of Lemire's writing here, is he didn't take the easy way out if portraying that this estrangement, this difficulty between Lester and his uncle was because of some bad feelings. You know, the uncle is not in any way a jackass or abusive or neglectful of Lester. He's doing the best he can.
He's just like a middle-aged man who doesn't know how to connect with the kid.
Yeah,
you know,
that's all it is. That's the sad part about it, is that both of them, you can tell, would like, that need that connection, but they can't seem to break through this wall. So,
exactly. And that's one of the things that makes this book so powerful, is it's not dealing in extremes. It's dealing in stuff that people really deal with in real life.
Right, exactly.
You know, so many books deal with extreme cases where, I mean, you know, if you take a similar story, but the uncle is you know, beating Lester or something like that. Like, you know, you take it and make it more extreme. It's really easy to get emotion out of that, but it can be kind of more surface emotion if all you're focusing on is, you know, bigger events to drive it. Something like this where you really have to, like, dwell and read into the subtleties of it, it's really relatable, even if you haven't experienced necessarily that thing. It's just like the whole time your heart's breaking for Lester and for the uncle, and, you know, even for Jimmy, where, you know he's done something bad to cause this, so you may not feel as bad for him as for the, you know, what the other two are going through, but you see that desire in him to make a connection, just like you see the desire in Lester and in Uncle Ken. We move on to the second volume here, called Ghost Stories, and this is about the two brothers who are hockey players. I love the image right after you get past the title page. It's the first page of the first first issue, first chapter, whatever, of this section of the book. And man, just the way that Jeff Lemire does his art, it could just be so amazing sometimes. This image is there's like kind of a background of the lines on a hockey rink, the center line, blue lines, except they're not blue because it's in black and white. But then like on that image, just like if that was a piece of paper and then Jeff Lemire drew right on it, you have the image of this old man crying, and then the tears from one of his eyes shoots over and is connected with these hockey players, one in particular, that are kind of set up like cardboard cutouts on the side.
Right.
It's just, it's a beautiful image. And it just it leaves you going right into this one. This is going to be bad.
Yep.
So you get into the story. You can help me with names as I go. I'm always bad remembering names. But this is the older brother. Do you recall his name offhand?
Lou,
okay. And what's the younger brother's name?
Vince. Lou and Vince.
Okay, Lou and Vince. Thank you. So Lou's an old man here, and you get the country nurse coming in.
His name is Anne.
Anne. Yeah, there you go. See, this is why I have you here for the names. So Anne shows up to take care of Lou. Lou's an old man. He's pretty much deaf. He doesn't like talking at first, though, because he sounds funny, which he tells us. It touches like that to add a little bit of humor to this without it just being a joke.
Right.
That just it adds more humanity to all of it. You know, people are sad, people are angry, all these different things. But there's always some humor there, too. And there's some humor in, you know, why won't you talk? And, you know, the deaf guy that can't hear how he talks is because I sound funny. You know, it's like he's this old man that doesn't really care about much, but he's self-conscious about that. And you see we've seen the crow throughout this, and you see the crow prominently in the beginning of this too. We'll talk a little bit more about the crow later. He's
right.
The crow is definitely used just to kind of tie the threads of the story together with an imagery that is, you know, used throughout, but it gets attention drawn to it more specifically later. So they did give us a little bit of an introduction of Essex County and where the farm is. So you get a little bit more sense of Essex County. You get to know this old man a little bit. He walks into the water here, and then he starts having a flashback to his brother when they were kids. And this is another great part that just really adds to the humanity. He's the older brother. His younger brother is having trouble getting his skates on, so he goes over to help him and says, you know, basically, you're better at everything involved with hockey than I am except tying your skates. You can skate faster than me, shoot harder than me, but you can't tie your skates yet.
Right.
And it's just two brothers playing hockey. So, right there we're getting the beginning of their story of them just being brothers playing together. And then he comes back to reality. He's dealing with Anne, the nurse, again, who is upset because he wandered off and came back soaking wet. And he goes drifting off into his memories again, and it's memories of 1951 when he was a young man going to the city to play hockey. No, actually, I take that back. This is when his brother was coming to the city. He's already in the city playing hockey.
Right.
So Vince shows up with his girl at his side. His girl is Beth Morgan. Vince meets right off the bat. They, without blatantly saying it, they subtly let you know that there's a little bit of a connection between the two of them. But that's kind of all at the moment. So time goes on. They're settling in the city. Beth is a little more excited to be in the city than Vince, who would really just rather be back at the farm. You meet all the rest of the hockey team, a bunch of characters. Get some nice humor added into the book there, the coach. They start playing hockey.
The assistant coach is really funny because he just kind of parrots whatever the coach says during the pep talk before the game. It was funny.
Oh, that's great. Comes in, coach is on the way, and the coach comes in and just runs around shouting at them. He's in the bed. It's great too, is the coach is a little more lascivious with how he's talking.
Right.
It's goddamn embarrassing, and then the assistant, GD embarrassing, boys. That's great how it's done. So in the middle of all these heavy stories, you get stuff like this that just really adds a much lighter heart to it. The game starts, you're getting the story of a hockey game, which oftentimes having to be subjected to the story of a sports game is tedious, but it's done really well here, so it's not tedious, because it's focusing a lot on the characters rather than just the action. And ultimately, Lou realizes he has to get his brother Vince going, because his brother is not playing with any fire, so he goes and picks a fight and gets his ass kicked on purpose. And Vince comes out and starts kicking everybody's ass. And they end up coming back and winning the game. And success starts to grow for them from that point. Go back to him jumping back to being an old man. He goes downstairs. He's still in his farmhouse here. goes downstairs, sits down with some of his hidden booze, falls asleep at the kitchen table as he drifts back off to his memories of them as young men celebrating together after their victory.
Right.
So they're in this bar, restaurant. What is this? The fuel station.
Yeah. Some sort of a club, bar, pub or something.
Yeah, this is where they really unveil Vince's desire just to be back at the farm. He's kind of excited to be in the city. He wants to do it for a little bit, but really his goal in life is just be get back to the farm and have a family.
And that's
they really portray that. Yeah.
I mean, that's the ironic part about this whole thing, because here's Lou, who wants to be in the NHL, will give anything to be in the NHL, but he just doesn't have quite the talent. Vince does, and he could easily make it, yet that's not what he wants. So it's a really, I think that's sort of the beginning of sort of the tension between the two brothers, because neither one of them understands what the other one's wanting. You know, Lou can't understand why Vince just doesn't want to sit there and have a great career in the NHL. And Vince is like, you know, why is Lou up here in the city when he could be back on the farm?
Yeah. I mean, really, ultimately, you get layers of jealousy that Lou has towards Vince.
Right.
Between his ability playing hockey and his girlfriend here, who ends up becoming his wife later. But throughout this scene, you see old Lou intermingling with his memories, which Lemire does such a good job with this, portraying all the emotions that are going on. You know, you're really able to kind of put yourself in the shoes of an old man remembering these things and, you know, having to deal with how painful it is to have these memories. And they're not just good memories, because he has these happy memories of something that was never his to have. And they fade away back to the real world. The nurse, Anne, comes back, finds him asleep at the table, realizes that he's drinking booze. He storms off, and you get a glimpse of Anne there, where she's trying to do things to help people all the time, putting other people out of herself, and she has to deal with people's crap all the time. She gets yelled at by this old man, and it's always put in this position where she has to feel bad because of other people dealing with their issues.
Yeah, it's really amazing story. And of course, we see that Lou does go back. I mean, Vince does go back to the farm. And then there's this, you know, was it 25 years that they don't even talk or barely talk?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we haven't even quite gotten to that point yet. So they more hockey going on, success, success, success. Good things happen. They go to, they're all hanging out, celebrating together. And this is where Vince falls asleep and Lou and Beth end up going up to the roof together when it's snowing. And so this is where, you know, Beth isn't Vince's to have.
Right.
And he goes up to the roof with her, and they end up not just going out and seeing the snow. They end up doing something you shouldn't do with your brother's girlfriend.
Nope. They certainly did. So, yeah. And that was a big, big turning point right there.
Yeah. I mean, this is the turning point. Vince takes something that's not his. Or, sorry, Lou takes something that's not his. He has sex with Beth. And that was the only time. And they have the panel says that was the last time I would ever touch her. They both look very sad with their choice right after doing it. They gave in to the emotion, the passion of the moment, and they realized it was wrong. And then Lou is alone again. Vince goes back to the farm. They start a family. They don't see each other for 25 years.
And what brings them back together is the death of their mother, you know, many years later.
And yep.
Lou goes back to the farm for her funeral. And, you know, we get a lot of tense exchange between Lou and Vince there, because it's unclear as to when Vince found out about Lou and Beth. You know, was it fairly straight off, or was it years later? I never really got the sense of where that happens, but at some point he knew, and certainly by the time that Lou came home for their mother's funeral, he was aware, fully aware of what had gone on.
Yeah, they never do make that clear, and I think that they utilize that, Jeff Lemire utilizes that to make the tension just so much worse. In the interim between when Vince goes back to the farm, when they stop communicating, and when their mother dies, Lou's not living the dream. His life is just really kind of getting worse and worse. He's feeling more isolated, more alone. He makes the statement in the book a couple of times that the two ways to feel the most alone is to be lost in a crowd or to be all by yourself.
Right.
And so you're kind of getting – he's lost in the crowd. And Vince goes off. He's not all by himself because he has his family. He has what he wanted. The mother dies. Lou goes to visit. He meets his niece.
Mary.
And, yeah, he – like, this is kind of a special moment. He's never met his niece, who by now is an adult.
Right.
And – but – you could, it's like it reminds him of her mom when you know her mom was younger, whatnot.
She certainly looked like her the way Lemire drew her. I mean,
yeah. So it's I don't know if it brings Lou back to how he felt before everything went wrong or what. But it is just kind of they've never met. She's excited to meet her uncle, but like, why haven't you met your uncle after 25 years? So there's this tension. Beth comes and tells Mary to go help in the kitchen. They have Lou and Beth have an uncomfortable exchange. He goes out to talk to Vince, and it's, man, just the tension is ridiculous. They're just talking like nothing's wrong until it gets a little too close to the subject, and then Vince just calls him on it and says he wants Lou to say what happened.
Right.
Lou won't do it. Lou picks a fight and makes sure he loses because that's the way to avoid really dealing with the situation.
Yeah, and he really drove a nail between him when he said that, because the way he picked the fight was he just comes back to Vince and said, "She loved me too, you know." And that sent Vince over the edge. He couldn't even comprehend the thought of that.
Yep. So until more tragedy comes, that ends their relationship. So Lou continually, instead of dealing with the people he has to deal with, he continues to force himself into isolation so he doesn't have to deal with those things. And he's in pain because he sees these things that he wants, and he just destroys it. He just drives it away because he can't deal with the hard parts.
Right.
All right, so then we go through more of his life in the interim. He can't drive the trolley that he was driving because he's going too deaf. He ends up coaching some kids hockey. Sees that his niece had a child. He's all happy about that. She's married, has a baby. She starts writing him. So he's got some a little bit better stuff going in his life right now. Feeling a little less isolated. And then he gets a call that that something terrible has happened. There's been a car accident. Vince and Beth and Mary and the child, Jimmy, Lester's dad, they're in a car accident, and Beth and Mary are killed. Jimmy is fine, and Vince is hurt pretty bad.
Yeah.
So now they're forced back together again. Because of this tragedy, Lou goes back to the farm. Vince can't really get along on his own. Lou can't really get along on his own. He's going deaf. So they get by on the farm together, but Jimmy goes to live with another family because these two old men with their problems can't take care of a kid.
Right.
So we see them learning to live together on the farm, having their fights and stuff. But Jimmy's kind of like their bright spot. They look forward to when Jimmy comes to stay with them for visits. They watch hockey together, and you see Jimmy grow up, and then you see Jimmy on the screen. And it goes back to the story that we started hearing in the first volume, the Lester's story on the farm, where Jimmy gets his chance to go and play hockey in the pros, which is something that Lou wanted so bad that, you know, Vince had the ability to get there, but the family was the most important thing. So they're both, you know, Vince has, you know, he's seeing his family succeed. Lou is seeing his family get to the heights that he always hoped to get to. And it's another piece of the story that it has an ending that's tragic, but also not tragic, because Jimmy got to the majors and he scored a goal. And that's how he remembers it. But everybody else, as he says in the first story, just remembers the hit that ended his career and left him a little slow in most people's estimation after that point.
Yeah, which I don't believe. Nothing of we see of Jimmy believes me to believe that. So it's, you wonder if it's kind of just a justification people came up with for why, you know, his career was over. But yeah, so yeah, the pieces are really starting to fall together now. We're really starting to see how these characters are, you know, interleaving with their, intertwining with their stories.
Yeah, and I love this part. I'm on page 318 now, and the old man Lou is out walking in the snow. This is not in his flashback. This is in
right.
Well, actually, you know what? Now that I'm looking at it, he just had an argument with Vince. Oh, yeah, so this isn't his flashback. This is now. And he crossed paths with Lester. And in the first volume, we see Lester kind of run away from home, go on this long walk in the snow, because he goes to the SO station where Jimmy's working. And that was the point in the first story, too, where Jimmy kind of, he had talked with Ken. Ken didn't want him around Lester. So that's where he kind of harshly drove a wedge in between them before the end of the first story, where he goes and has the final battle with the space aliens with Lester. That kind of, even though they're kind of split in their ways at that point, it fixed the way the separation was done. But so seeing them cross paths right here, just it brings everything together in a way. You see these two guys that, you know, one's an old man, one's a kid, and they're out walking in the cold, in the snow, not exactly well attired for it, it looks either, at a time of night that they both have somewhere they should be. And they're both, you know, trying to work through these mental pains and sorrows. And, you know, it, even though they're going through different things, it really, a big thing I think this whole book is illustrating is that everybody has things that they're dealing with. And everybody's story is different, but everybody has these pains and these sorrows and these, you know, mentally anguishing things that they have to deal with. And, you know, we're all crossing paths like that every day, and we don't really think about that. But it's a good interaction between them. Another little point of levity without being a joke.
And it's really, it's poignant because, I mean, this is, Lester's come across the man who is his grandfather's brother. He doesn't know it, but, you know, here's that. I think it's an interesting symbolism. Here he comes close to a family member, but that's all. It's just a passing thing, and they just walk past each other and keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Another.
Yeah, you see more of the isolation in both of their cases. They have family right there, and they're so caught up in the barriers that they create that they don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
So then we get back to the flashback and Vince dying, and that's a pretty sad scene. Lou's brother dying, and even though all they, you know, they didn't get along, they fought, they had these big barriers between them, this is, you know, it's still a hard moment for Lou to take, his brother dying. He doesn't want to be all alone. And he has the, I don't know what you call this, the fantasy, or I don't know if this is just like a kind of a break in his memory, but he imagines all the boys from the hockey team around tapping their sticks like, you know, hockey players would do on the ice when somebody gets hurt, you know, giving them support while they're dealing with it.
Yeah.
That's one of the most touching and heartbreaking scenes of the book for me, too, right there.
Yeah, that was really powerful. Because the way he does it, he builds up to that. On the previous page, you hear one little tap, and then tap, tap, and then gradually more and more, it gets louder and louder. Then it goes to this, it's a, you know, really a two-page spread, panorama of, you know, Lou holding Vince, you know, who just passed away, and then surrounded by the hockey team, all tapping their sticks.
Yeah, that's such a touching panel. And it's, you know, there are so many layers to it, too, because, you know, his brother just died. You understand the, you know, the symbolism of the hockey team there, but it's also this complete departure from reality, which ties into what's really going on for Lou right now, where he's getting senile and he is losing his connection with reality.
Right.
And, you know, he's, you know, clearly getting pretty close to the end of his rope too. And there's some threads here that, in the third volume, which we're getting to now, the country nurse, he's instrumental in bringing some stuff together and changing the outcome of something. So this story is centered around the country nurse, Anne. You see all the things she's doing. You know, Jeff Lemire's showing here that she's good at being a mom, good at being a caretaker, doing the kind of things that people do, you know, taking care of things around the home and taking care of people and those sorts of things. And, it gets real late. She goes to bed. She wakes up in the morning, cooking breakfast, wakes up her son. He's going to be late for work. He's kind of a jerk. Comes in, rude to his mom, won't sit and eat breakfast. Leaves, slams the door. She's all alone. So we're back to isolation. Here she is, you know, the beginning of this story, taking care of her son. And he's ungrateful, and she has this isolation because of it. Then you see her driving, the crows flying. She goes to the Esso station and sees Jimmy. And while she's there, she tells him he's going to see his Uncle Lou. He's picking up some magazines for Lou, talking to Jimmy, saying he needs to go visit his uncle. So she's kind of, she says throughout this and later on, she's kind of meddling, but trying to help these people do the things that they should do with their relationships with each other. And when she leaves, this is one of the things that just the subtleties of the art, where she says, I owe you, you know, okay, Jimmy, I owe you this much for the gas and whatever. And he says, don't worry about it. And she goes on her way. Then he's sitting there with a sad look on his face, but looking straight forward. And then the next panel is just a little bit tilted down, just a little bit further down.
Mm-hmm.
But just such subtle things like that say so much more than anything more pronounced could. You see, everything they were just talking about is such a struggle for him. You know, it's tied so much into the things he's trying to cope with and deal with. And that just that little tilt just shows the weight that it is on him.
Yeah, exactly. And I could really go off on a long talk about the artwork, Lemire's artwork, because I think it's absolutely brilliant. I think he's a damned accomplished artist. And a lot of people, I don't think, would look at the style and not necessarily say that. You know, as compared to somebody, what he does, I could point to example. That's one example of what he does. But just because his style is very, and this is where it's hard to come up with words to describe. A lot of people will say something, oh, his style is very sketchy, which is something I try to avoid because that doesn't say anything. That's a totally ambiguous word. Yeah, his style is very, I guess what I would call it is abstracted, abstract.
Yeah, there's an abstract nature to it. It's simpler. It's more line-based. You know, there's not as much shading, and obviously in this there's not color.
But at the same time, you know, you can look at this and you see that Lemire has mastered everything about good drawing. That one panel that's back in the second book where it's showing the entire Colosseum, the Hockey Colosseum, and how the lines converge. You know, he understands perspective. He understands line weight. He understands negative spacing. He understands shading when he does do it. It's like he knows everything there is to know. You know, and what he chooses to put in and put out and not put in is really brilliant.
Yeah,
and he can do like that one where Jimmy just that slight tilt of his head just speaks volumes. That's really subtle.
Yeah, and I think that a big aspect of it is the fact that he's fully in control of everything he's doing with his art. You know, people can look at this and dismiss it because it's simple. You know, it's not colorful and flashy and stuff like that. But that's not really illustrating a good grasp on, or a good breadth of knowledge or breadth of taste, I don't know, on art to be dismissive of something like this, because he is using this art to tell a story, and he's doing that so well. You can compare, I don't know, let's take something drastic. Take, you know, one of his best panels here and compare it to, like, an Alex Ross cover, which we know that those are beautiful, right? Like, yeah. Alex Ross does a great job. Well, they're trying to accomplish different things. So, you know, a lot of comic fans, when they look at art, they want art to be, you know, pretty strongly rendered. They want those colors. They want the dynamic. You know, like, one of the reasons you always see stuff like, you know, prominent boobs in comics is because people want the basic things that they're drawn to. Like, if you take that as an example, you know, there's a lot of boobs in comics because people want to see boobs, right? It's a base draw, right? Like, it's a base thing that's drawing you to that. You want that, the sex, the titillation. And that's what draws you to that. You know, just like you want to see the highly rendered stuff because it's the, on a basic level, it's the most visually appealing. You know, you want to see the colors and like all those things. On a base level, it's the best. But that doesn't mean that it's the best for everything. You know, a highly rendered cover is a fantastic thing. You know, an Alex Ross cover is fantastic. If you had an entire comic that was made like that, it would be kind of hard to tell a story with stuff rendered in that way because there are so many things that you can't tell if you're just trying to make the picture as beautiful as possible.
Right. Yeah.
So it's for telling a story, it's a totally different thing, you know?
Because I think, you know, to me, the way, and really even an Alex Ross painting, all art is abstract from in some form, you know, because it's two-dimensional. It's taking things out. It's not showing reality, no matter how realistic it looks. And I think the more detailed and the more you try to emulate reality, the more rigid it gets, you know, or the more you're putting things around it, and instead of letting, you know, the consumer, whoever's reading and looking at this art, sort of, you know, take it in and have it go into their senses.
Yeah, you know, I just thought of an example I think that illustrates what I'm trying to get at, too, that ties into something different with literature. Have you ever read Moby Dick?
Yes.
I haven't read Moby Dick, but my wife read it, and she really struggled through it. And her biggest complaint with it was the level of detail. It was going into such detail explaining these things that had nothing to do with the story, but it's explaining about sailing and tying knots and like stuff like that, that it has nothing to do with a story that is about, you know, the captain trying to catch this whale and all the themes and stuff within it. Then you take another, you know, great piece of literature, like, I don't know, Catcher in the Rye is a fairly short book. It's not a very long book.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, I mean, I don't know how many, you know, the page count of Moby Dick, but it's, I don't know, 700 pages. It's big. compared to 150 pages, 200 pages, and they're both just telling a story. It's not like the story of Moby Dick is so much more massive of a story that it has to be told and told and told. It's all the details put into it.
Right, and that
it's a different kind of art. Like Moby Dick is a classic for a reason. It's a piece of art, but it's accomplishing something different than the piece of art that Catcher in the Rye is. Right. Catcher in the Rye is telling a story, telling characters, portraying heart. And Moby Dick is portraying a story also, but the details are such a part of what makes it art that it's doing something totally different.
And also, but at the same time, I'm not sure that the details don't necessarily make it. Even if you're trying to do that, that style doesn't necessarily make it art. Because another example that I thought of, in oh man, a lot of people will label me a blasphemer for saying this. I've always thought the Lord of the Rings trilogy could be shortened by at least a third. I thought
that I was actually thinking about that too, but I didn't want to go Lord of the Rings.
I mean, it's like every third page there's some song that they're singing, and it just there's so much superfluous, or there's a lot of superfluous stuff in there that could have all been taken out, and it wouldn't have affected the story at all. In fact, I think it would have enhanced it. So.
Yeah, the Hobbit is about the length of one volume of Lord of the Rings, right? So Lord of the Rings is about three times as long.
Yeah.
I think The Hobbit has as much story in it as all three volumes of The Lord of the Rings does.
I agree.
And I think that that's a good example. And, you know, with Tolkien, I guess it's a very good example because some people love Tolkien. And Tolkien is a master of doing that sort of thing, having that level of detail. And for writers who do things like that and create a world and spell out that level of detail – I think Tolkien is much more enjoyable than a lot of them because there are other writers who do the same thing, and I'd rather stab myself in the face than read their shit.
Yeah.
No,
I like Tolkien and I like The Lord of the Rings. I just, you know, just looking at it with a critical eye.
Exactly.
You know, this not all this needed to be here, really, in my opinion. But.
Yeah, and some people want that level of detail, and I think that when you put it in those terms, like with comic art. The high level of detail is the easy connection. And the art like Jeff Lemire is using in this is the harder connection. You have to work more to connect to it.
Right.
And in The Lord of the Rings, or with literature, the high level of detail is harder to connect with than the lower level of detail that's easier to connect with emotionally and everything. So, all right, let's see. Where were we at?
Okay, we just talked about... Well, I kind of got off on a tangent, but we talked about Anne going to the gas station. She saw Jimmy.
And oh, yeah,
right,
yeah,
after that, it's where it starts. It introduces, we have the furthest flashback we've had in the story, all the way back to 1917.
Yeah, so Anne brings the whole threads not only of this family we've been talking about this whole time together, but she's also bringing the threads of Essex County itself together.
Right.
So, as you just mentioned, we get a flashback to a really long time ago. And, of course, there's hockey involved because there's always hockey involved.
Right.
Kids playing hockey. So this is just kind of like a glimpse at what's going on.
You don't exactly
know it right here, but it's an orphanage. And, you know, these kids are playing hockey. And talk about isolation. They're really isolated here in this orphanage. This is 1917, times were different, and they probably shove an orphanage out in the middle of nowhere like that, so...
Right.
I don't know why they do, but it seems like it's always that way when you read something or watch a movie with an orphanage. Then we come back to present, and we see Anne go into the farm where Lester is. And you get a flashback to Lester's mom dying, and Anne was there as a caregiver. So there's more connections throughout the story. All the threads throughout this are just astounding. Anne goes and talks to Uncle Kenny, checking on his hand that got hurt. You find out that they've been getting along better, Lester and Ken. Lester's been helping out more at the farm. And this is where, as we said earlier, Anne tells Ken that he's being selfish, not talking to Lester about who his family is and that Jimmy's his father and that Lester needs all the family he can get right now. Lester overhears this. You hear them, Ann and Ken, finish the conversation. And Lester thinks about this, walks off. You see him go to a little shack, I guess. It looks like something he built himself. And you see his mask and cape there, and he has a slingshot. That brings us back into the flashback way back when. And you see the caretaker for this orphanage with a boy who is like the oldest boy in the orphanage. He's about old enough to go off as an adult and make his way in the world. And you get a sense of the heart of this caretaker. Do you recall his name?
Charles, I believe it is.
Charles, look at you. So good with names. This is why I keep you around. So they head back to the orphanage. And then we flash back to the current. And Anne is visiting the grave of her husband and talking to him about what's going on in her life and kind of admitting to him the struggles that she's going through. So with all these people that are isolated, that are creating barriers between them and the people that they want, Anne's the one where she's not trying to create the barriers. She's trying to knock barriers down, but still she's dealing with isolation just like everybody else is. Then she goes to the nursing home, and she finds out that Lou has passed away. And goes and says hi to her grandmother, who at this point, I don't know, did they connect with you at this point? Well, no, I guess they didn't really get far enough into the story yet. But her grandmother, we see her here for the first time. You don't really know who she is, but she says, how's the oldest woman in Essex County today? As you get later in the flashback story, her grandmother is the nun at this orphanage.
Right.
So she talks to her grandmother. Then you get the flashback from the grandmother to the nun, and that's where you make the connection. The caretaker, Charles, here comes in, and she's kind of cold to him. And there's the crow. The crow is his pet. The crow leads them later on. And it's just like he's been leading us through the whole story. So you kind of see what the deeper meaning of the crow is. So Margaret, Sister Margaret here is being kind of cold to Mr. Gerard Charles. And this is also kind of reminiscent of what happened with Beth and Lou and Vince, where you realize as this goes on that they did the same dirty deed that Lou and Beth did that created a divide in between them. Right. And Vince. And here you have it where she's a nun. She's probably not supposed to sleep with the caretaker. And because of that, she's driving him away. You know, she feels it's more proper. Well, it probably is by now because, you know, they already did what they shouldn't have done. That's why it was more proper in the first place. And it's nighttime and Charles is in his shack and she's thinking about it, sewing on her quilt or whatnot. And we flash back to the present, and Anne is going in to the farm where Lou lived. And she's taking a look around downstairs, and she finds stuff about Jimmy, the scrapbook that they were keeping when Jimmy was, you know, growing up and making his way in the world of hockey.
Right.
And we flash back over to Ken and Lester, and you get the crow again. Takes you back to the past, and there's a fire, and Charles has to rescue Margaret and the children from the orphanage. He gets most of them out, but then there is the one boy, Lawrence, that's trapped in there. So Charles goes in and helps him get out, but he gets caught and can't get out, and Charles dies. Once again, the separation that people cause that create this isolation leads to greater harm because Margaret won't let him sleep in the house even though it's winter and it's cold. He ends up dying saving them because she can't deal with what happened and creates that isolation and that separation.
Yes.
And this leads to them having to make their way to the settlement of Essex County.
Yep.
Anne goes and visits Jimmy, gives him a box of the stuff from Lou's, from them following what went on with him. She gives him the nudge to try to make the connection with his son Lester. More of the story of the nun and the kids getting to Essex County, and this is where you see that she's pregnant. Then we're back to Lester and Ken. And Ken gets a knock at the door. It's Jimmy. They have another argument because they can't get along because they haven't worked past their own wedges creating their isolation. Jimmy gives him the box of stuff that he got from Anne about his grown up. Ken takes it. We go back to Lester and his comic book he's making. And Ken comes in and sits down by Lester and puts the box down in between them.
I thought this was a really well done portrayal here. And it really showed a lot about these two characters. Because Jimmy didn't try to go himself. He didn't go to Lester himself and say, I'm your father. Look at this stuff. He respected the situation enough to say, okay, Kenny is taking care of Lester right now. He's his guardian. So he goes to Kenny and gives him the stuff. Yeah, they get into an argument. But ultimately, he leaves it to him. He says, here's the memorabilia. You choose what to do with it. And then Kenny takes it and shows it to Lester, which shows a lot of, I think, character. Because, as you've seen, things were improving between Lester and Kenny. They didn't have that estrangement. I'm sure it was, very difficult for him to do that because he was like, okay, well, things are getting better. It's just going to continue to get better. We're just going to go on, and I'll end up raising him until he's an adult. But he ends up doing, what he thinks is right and giving Jimmy that box. And I love the way Lemire did that after it shows him putting the – Kenny goes in and says, we need to talk. And then the rest of the panels are nonverbal. In fact, you see some of it through a window, and the crow is looking at them through the window as they're obviously discussing what's going on. And then at the last panel, you see Kenny put the box down next to Lester. That is brilliant storytelling. That is really brilliant storytelling.
Yeah, so much more is said in three panels where you're separated off. There's a barrier between you and what you're trying to see is going on. You can't hear what's being said. You don't really, there's a separation there, but it shows so much more because you're reading the emotions of the people, without it being clearly portrayed. And, it's one of the cases where the suggestion of something is so much more powerful than just explicitly showing what's happening.
Yeah.
And with this, with the conversation, with emotions and everything going on here, we're getting to the point of this book where it's really about we've built up so many barriers and so many, so many things that cause the isolation between all these characters. And we're starting to see those being removed. If you're chopping into a tree and you take a wedge and wedge it in there and you cause that split, you see the trees getting torn apart, but you get a scene like this and I think of just pulling that wedge out and watching the tree slowly force itself back together. It hasn't been wedged apart so much that it's destroyed. The tree hasn't been chopped down yet. There's not enough chunks out of it yet to leave these big marring marks. It's just the wedge has been being pushed in and pushed in, and now they're pulling it out instead of pushing it in further. That's the last we see of Lester and Kenny here. And there's just so much shown about their relationship right there. You see that they've been working on getting closer together. We don't see Jimmy, I don't believe, again anymore in this either. But just with this, Kenny's showing Lester who his dad is. That they became buddies earlier on. And with how Lester's processing all the pieces of what all these things are, kind of leads you to, okay, Lester's going to take this gesture from his uncle, which is going to help their relationship. he's going to now know that Jimmy's his father. They're going to be able to start a relationship. You know, Ken is taking the chance to trust Jimmy so they can start patching up a severely damaged relationship. And there's just so many of the pieces are starting to get tied back together. And that's all we know. It stops there. There's nothing more told to us about that, but it leaves us with so much promise for what they went through. And then this next little segment of the flashback, Lawrence he was always kind of relatable to Lester, but here you have the blanket tied around his shoulders like a cape, and so it really kind of relates, you know.
Well done.
Yeah, close to a century apart relates him to Lester, and Mr. Gerard's crow is leading them to Essex County. And he stops and sees the crow and realizes, and they follow the crow, and it leads them to salvation. It leads them to Essex County, so they're not going to die out in the cold. And then after that, this is where you get the family trees of these two different families, and you see all the connection. You know, there's the two different families. They don't cross. You know, their branches don't connect at all. But you still, Anne is so tied into everything that happened with all these other different people. But it is kind of nice just seeing it laid out and seeing how these people are connected.
Right.
And seeing the ways that they relate them.
And it was funny because as I was reading this, I was making notes. I was drawing this myself because I was trying to keep everything straight. So I was like, okay, this so-and-so, Jimmy and Claire. So I was kind of making one of these up myself before I even realized this was in the book. So.
Yeah. And then the last part of it is, and I like the panel layout too. There's two pages here that are, it's nine panels just laid out really basically. Showing Anne doing her thing, looking at a photo of her husband and starting to talk to her husband, Doug, telling him about her day, about the people that she knows and works with and deals with, her son, you know, owning up to the fact that she meddles, but that she does it to help people. And we know that she's been instrumental in helping all these different characters we've talked about in a lot of different ways, you know, and she has this isolation where she doesn't have somebody there with her. Her husband's dead. Her son is, you know, at that age, I guess, is, as far as we know, I mean, we don't know if there's anything else there, but he's just being a young adult and being a little jerk. And
just being, you know, distant, right?
Yeah, exactly, being distant. But you see something different with her than you see in any of the other characters throughout this book, where they all had these separations, they had this isolation, and they weren't trying to fix it. They were causing it or making it worse. And, you know, they didn't want to deal with realities and deal with the difficult things. And Anne's going throughout all this and not being afraid of any of that. She's pushing people's buttons, pushing them together, giving them the nudges they need. And just her being there and knowing what's really important, we see the result, even though we don't see what it leads to. And now we see her here where this, I was a little mixed the first time. Well, not the first time, but in my reread, when I got to the ending here, my first thought was that this was a kind of a really sad ending. You get the promise of Lester and Ken and Jimmy with that part. But then you get this part and she's sad. Like who does she have? You know, her husband's dead. Her son's distant. But when you read it again and look at her with it, you know, she isn't dwelling on the negativity. She isn't dwelling on all the bad things there. You know, she just kind of sees this stuff happens and you just have to work towards, you know, bringing things back together.
Well, and then she kind of even alludes to it that, you know, that it's her patients or her family now. And those are the people that, you know, she's there to care for them. And so that's where she gets, you know, her sense of connectedness, I think, now.
Yeah, and it makes it hard. You know, she has to deal with the hardship of losing a patient like Lou, who even if he was just a pain in the butt, you know, he became family to her. And that's what makes her good at doing what she does, is she really is a caretaker. And when she's caring for people, she's not just caring for their physical needs. She's caring for what she sees as, you know, their emotional needs.
Right.
Even somebody like Jimmy, where, you know, he's not her patient, but he was intertwined with with all these different patients. So, you know, she was taking care of Uncle Ken's hand. She was there for Lester's mom when she died. So she's tied to Lester that way. It's all interconnected. She's this thread that is connecting them all. And so, I mean, you could see the end as being sad. She, you know, her husband's dead and her son is distant. But just like you said, she admits her son just doesn't need her right now. You know, he's a young adult. He doesn't need somebody to take care of him at the moment. He just needs to, you know, be an adult and figure it out. Yeah, it's a good ending. And then if, you know, for anybody who has gone or goes out and gets this collected volume, after this point, there's a couple of short stories that are pretty good. I don't think we'll take the time to go into those right now, but they're fun stories.
They are. I'm not sure how the publication history of where these are published, because I know the three main books are published separately, but how these originally came out, I don't know. So, but they're,
yeah, I think there's a little bit of details in the notes. So you have the story about the boxing club, and then you have the elephant ears story, and then you have some just extra material after that. I think the extra material does a little bit to talk about how stuff came out and was, you know, was released.
Yeah, together a lot of his working like that, material, you know, his original concepts.
Yeah, so I think throughout this we did pretty good of hitting the points we wanted to get to.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot for us to sum up. We talked about the, you know, the major themes of this, and you know, the emotional impact is what really makes this book special, and then also what makes Jeff Lemire's art so special. Are there any final thoughts that jump out to you with
No, S6? I mean, other than, you know, we talked about the crow, and the crow fooled me at first as to what he was representing, because he first shows up right before he had the flashback of Lester's mother dying. And I knew from other reading that traditionally in literature, a crow is symbolic of death because they're carrion. They feed off of already dead animals. So I was thinking, okay, well, this crow is just coming through here representing death. But that's not at all what it is. It's the complete opposite. And as you weave through the story, it becomes apparent. And in fact, that's the last pages of the novel, or not the novel, of the book, is the crow at night flying off and actually leaving Essex County, sort of as, okay, it's done. What I was here to do is over with, and off to whatever else is next.
Yeah. I mean, they you know, unveil so much about the crow towards the end of it, with it being Charles's crow and leading the nun and the kids to safety in Essex County, and you see the impact that Sister Margaret had on Essex County. You know, she's still around. She's the oldest living lady in Essex County. So, you know, Essex County already existed, but obviously there's a lot of impact that came from her lineage there.
Right.
You know, she begat Anne, who is instrumental in this long lineage of people that, you know, before Anne was part of their personal story, you know, they had all this fragmentation and everything happening with them. And Anne was instrumental in bringing them back. So the crow's there guiding Sister Margaret to Essex County. You know, and down the line you get Anne, and the crow's there guiding Anne, you know, among all the threads of what's going on in this other family's life. So she could be there and be a part of it and help them tie everything back together.
Exactly. But that was all I had. I mean, we've covered this pretty well, I think.
Yeah, this one, there's just so much to this book. And I mean, it's pretty long, but it's like 500 pages, but it reads really fast.
Yeah,
because
first time I read it, I could not put it down. It's just, it just drags you along, and you have to see what's next and what's next and what's next. And
yeah, it keeps you hooked. It's a really quick read, but there's so much portrayed so quickly, and that it's absorbs so quickly, you know, which all that goes back to why Jeff Lemire's art in it is so well done. This book, I think, is one of both of our favorites for a big reason. I've heard this book resonate with a lot of people. A lot of people suggested this book when we were, Martin and I were first coming up with the idea for this podcast. A lot of people threw this book out as a suggestion. And a lot of people, if you ask, you know, what should you read of Jeff Lemire's, I think this book just about always comes up. And then it's usually this and something else may change. But this book just seems to be a common thread with everybody. So anybody who took time to listen to all this and hasn't, definitely pick up Essex County. All three volumes are collected in a rather affordable package. I think the cover price is like $30, so it's not hard to get, and definitely worth it.
And you can get a good price for it in stock trades or other places. So.
Yeah, I think it's like $21 on in-stock trades. Can't beat that. So everybody go check it out. And coming up for next time, most likely, Jay and I discussed it, and we are going to be talking about Motor Girl from Terry Moore, a currently running series. I think this is the first time we're doing anything that has a still-beating heart while we're doing it. So 5 issues are out at this moment, which will be what we talk about. And then I'm sure at some point Motor Girl is going to run 10 issues. So at some point, once the whole series is out, we'll do a kind of a final episode on Motor Girl. And hopefully we'll get Ronnie at least involved. I know possibly a couple other people. We had a lot of people that are interested in being involved in Terry Moore subject matter. Ronnie was going to join us for this episode, as a matter of fact, but just things were too busy and he wasn't able to. So hopefully he'll be with us next time. But yeah, so anybody who's interested in Motor Girl, 5 issues are out, and the first trade paperback is out, which contains those 5 issues. So anybody who wants to check it out, you don't have to track down all the individual issues. You can just track down the trade paperback if you like. So until next time, Jay is on Twitter at JayForgets. Did I remember that correctly?
That is correct, sir.
All right. I'm on Twitter at Who's Paul. You can tweet the podcast at CBWPodcasts. You can email us at cbwpodcast@gmail.com. And, yeah, check out some Motor Girl. Let us know what you think of Essex County. And let us know if there's any other stuff we could check out in the future, because we need to get kind of our next queue of things set up. At some point in the future, we should have an ElfQuest episode. But as is often the case, Martin is busy and has not had time to do his reading yet. So I told him when he's ready. Then we'll do an ElfQuest episode. So until then, we'll do other things that are much less about cutely drawn little elves.
That was pathetic. Ooh.
Nerdy Legion.
All right, and now this is where my producer puts in some good outro music.
That doesn't really seem very punk to me.
Now I'm in Maine, far, far away from there.
Yeah, I'm going to rip your throat out.
I could really go off. Blasphemer.
Fingerprints on his face.
Valley Central.
new Jet song?
Nerdy Legion.
Mike is a good editor. Okay. Michael, start after this. Even though I think he just listens to the whole thing anyways.
Nerdy Legion.
But what are we, a team? No, we're a chemical mixture that makes chaos. We're a time bomb.
Ooh.